With that, I would like to begin the introduction for our this evening's speaker. That is Father Bob Lotz. Father Bob is a senior priest in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, and he was ordained in 1973. He served as an associate pastor for several years before specializing in young adult and campus ministry for the Archdiocese. He has been a director of adult and family ministry in the Archdiocese and an adjunct professor in the College of Professional Studies at Marquette University. He retired as pastor from Blessed Trinity in Sheboygan Falls and St. John the Evangelist in Kohler. And then we called him into duty in the city of Sheboygan. And so on the south side, you've seen him before, but just recently he has been at a number of our Sheboygan North Catholic parishes at our masses for help outs for weekends, and he conducts days of reflection, retreats, and adult education presentations. So with that, I'd like to introduce Father Bob. His talk this evening is titled Ways to Appreciate the Eucharist, based on a book by Monsignor Kevin Irwin, Methods of the Eucharist. Welcome, Father Bob.
I thank all of you. Glad that you applauded now. Then you don't have to worry about what I'm going to be saying, so I can just leave in quiet when it's time. It's wonderful to see so many of you here, and I understand that you've had a wonderful turnout throughout this season. Several years ago, before I retired, I had the honor of coming here a couple years in a row to do a couple of the series that you've had. And I've really always been impressed with you people in Sheboygan in terms of your desire to continue with adult formation. So thank you for inviting me to be part of that. This evening, you know, I was told that the theme for this particular year was going to be the Eucharist, because the last couple of years we've been trying to concentrate post-COVID on how to get people to appreciate the Eucharist again. It seems as though COVID did a lot to make us need to be isolated for the time that it needed to be, but then it's been difficult to have everyone come back as we once did. My thought is that we can't do that by forcing people to come. We do it best by educating people about the reason why we Catholics celebrate the Eucharist. And certainly that's because we believe that the Eucharist is the body and blood of Jesus. So we've been concentrating the last couple of years in the country talking about and reminding Catholics about the real presence of Jesus. Well, when I was asked to do this particular talk, I decided that I was going to expand that idea just a bit. So what we're going to be doing tonight is not talking so much about the real presence of Jesus in the bread and the wine. We're going to be talking about the Eucharist as the celebration of Christ's presence. I think all of us as Catholics sometimes are familiar with the idea that we use the term Eucharist to mean the Mass. And so that's what we're going to talk about tonight. We're not going to be talking primarily about the real presence of Jesus, but we're going to be talking about how we gather as God's people in the presence of Jesus to celebrate our faith and to grow in our relationship with God. So that's going to be the meaning of that word Eucharist for us as we take this time to think about life in general. So it's my talk tonight is based on a book called Models of the Eucharist. And as Mary mentioned, it's by Monsignor Kevin Irwin. And he is talking about different ways of looking at the Eucharist. You know, sometimes, if you're like me, you think that everybody understands exactly the same thing when you use a particular word. However, we know that that's not the case at all. We have so many different interpretations of the same word, and we have so many different interpretations of the same experience that we share. So even though we as Catholics share a lot of the same rituals and a lot of the same actions, we also each have our own individual experience of those things and a corresponding theology or idea about how those things lead us to God and how we grow in relationship with God. So one of the most important things that I learned as a student was that even though we say that we're the one holy Catholic and apostolic church, that doesn't mean we all come out like robots. It means that we take the time to try to understand with each other how broad and diverse the God is that we believe in, and that there are many, many responses that good people with goodwill have in growing their faith and their relationship. So what Kevin Irwin did was make a decision based on another book that he read, which I'll mention in just a couple of minutes, that there were many ways that we have to understand the Eucharist. And if any one of us feels as though our way is the only way, we probably need to go to God with that and say, sorry, make me a listener as well as a speaker. Make me understand the diversity of the way in which you speak to all of the people you've created, and get me past expecting everybody to do it the way that I know is right, because I don't always know what's right. So this book's purpose is to reflect on the jewel in the crown of Catholicism. That's what the author refers to the Eucharist as being, the jewel in the crown of Catholicism. It really is what makes us unique. Although as soon as I say that, I will backtrack and say the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church, and one of the denominations within the Lutheran Church also believe in the real presence of Jesus. So we're not the only ones who do that. But it is absolutely critical to us as Catholic Christians to believe in the real presence of Jesus. And because of that, that becomes the center point of everything we do in our sacramental system. We Catholics have the most sacraments, Episcopals also. We have the most sacraments in our system of sacraments, but it's still the central reality of Christ present in each of those, demonstrated most clearly in the Eucharist. So, Irwin set out to explore and explain. Can you see this with this thing? Okay. If not, you can move around wherever you need to. Or
do you need me to move something?
If I try moving that, I'm going to drop.
It's just the light.
The light.
Guaranteed.
The
light.
Oh, do you want lights off? Then I'm moving this picture, perhaps.
Thank you, Kim. Your middle name would not be Vanna, would it?
No.
Thank you.
A lot of good things.
Thank you, Kim. So, Irwin says that the purpose is to explore and explain as much as is possible. Because again, we're talking about mysteries. And isn't it unusual that we spend all our time saying that something is a mystery and then we try to explain it? Now we talk and talk and talk about it, trying to understand what it is, rather than just letting it be as awesome as it is. We human beings are creatures that want to try to understand, and that's wonderful. But we have to recognize that everything we're talking about, even in terms of human relationships with the people that are closest to us, can never be completely understood. There's always a mystery connected with relationship, and there's always something that's mysterious in our relationship, even within the very natural order of which we are part. So, again, back to him. To explore and explain what happens when Mass is celebrated and what our central act of worship means in terms of Catholic belief, and then in living the Catholic life. Because remember, we are not just to believe something intellectually. Our faith is a faith in action. So it's equally important for us to try to figure out what our attitudes and beliefs lead us to do as people of faith. We Catholics are an incarnational church. We believe, unlike some of the Protestant churches and some of the other non-Christian churches, we believe that Christ became body and blood as a human person and transformed everything that's human into good. Now, we might not always measure up to that, but being human people, having a body, having something that we can touch and feel is central to our faith as Catholics. Every sacrament, if you would go, how many of you remember the Baltimore Catechism? Okay, so what's a sacrament? It's an outward sign instituted by Christ to give grace. An outward sign simply means it's something I can see, touch, or feel. So when we gather in church, we're not supposed to be isolating ourselves from the real world. We're supposed to be getting the energy we need to transform the world into the kingdom of God. Because we are the body of Christ, we can do that. So, Erwin is talking about trying to figure out what it is we do on Sunday or Saturday night or at special times of the year whenever we're gathering at a different time to celebrate the Eucharist. What is it that we're trying to do? And what he discovered was that as he thought about the Eucharist, he realized that anything that's got to do with theology or a pastoral approach, meaning an approach that's going to help people grow in their relationship, anything that's theological and pastoral has to be lived by the church. Good theologians don't just spend their times in closets or in rooms somewhere isolating themselves from the world. They're doing their thinking to help the world become a little bit more clearly the presence of God, as well as helping people to understand. The dynamic character of the Eucharist is what Erwin talks about. It's living. It's not something we go to view. Yes, there is certainly a sacredness to the reality of the Eucharist, and we ought, as people of faith, to be respectful. But the Eucharist is not something that draws us away privately into a spiritual realm of me alone with God. That is not what it means to be an incarnational person. It's not why we're created as part of the world. We are called to be together. We are called not God and me, but God and us. The Jewish community understood that from its very inception, because God brought them together as a people and always spoke to them as a people. And individuals needed to take their responsibility for being part of the people very, very seriously. So too do you and I. Yes, it's important to get on our knees at times in our humility to understand God's awesomeness. Equally important is to take the risk of taking what we believe into the real world and helping to transform it. So there's a dynamic character to the Eucharist. When we gather to be nourished for when we leave, when we go out. That's when the Eucharist really lives. So just as a little bit of a background, back when I was in school, I've been in school for a long time, but when I was in seminary, let's put it that way, I was ordained in 1973. But we had to continue our education for a while post-ordination, which I always thought was a crazy but good thing. And in 1974, a Jesuit by the name of Avery Dulles published a book called Models of the Church, which was a look at five ways to understand the church as dynamic and multifaceted. Because for a long time, it would be fair to say that almost all the people who were alive at that time in 1974, we're viewing the church from our experience just past the Second Vatican Council. But most of us had the memory of before the council. And before the council, everything seemed pretty much the same for a lot of years, to the point where most of us at first felt we couldn't change, that it would be wrong to change, that we wouldn't want to update anything because we've always been like this. Not realizing that we've always been like this since probably 1898, which was before any of us were alive at that time, so it seemed like forever. But the church has a very, very long history of constant change and growth and development. Like the world, the church and faith are evolutionary. And don't let that word scare you. It simply means it continues to grow and develop. It's not stagnant. So, Dulles suggested that even though most of us thought we knew exactly what the church was, as he did his exploration, he came up with five different ways that the church in its history had looked at itself. And if you were to use some particularly descriptive words, it would be as institution. That was the one that most of us knew. The church was the institution whose center place was in Rome and whose boss was the Pope. And then it sort of filtered down into our experience. But it was an institution. Dulles suggested that's not the only thing the church has ever been. Yes, it is an institution, but it's also a mystical communion. Another reference point to that would be the body of Christ, or the mystical body, communion of saints, all those terms. We're united past, present, and to be. We transcend time and space. Now that's another thing that could really lead us off in another hole. I'd love to have us take a week or so to just sort of think about what it really means to be bound by space and time as we are right now, but then to start thinking about what it really means when we talk about God, who is not bound by space or time. So what does that mean about past, present, and future? What does it mean about where God is or where God isn't? Because it would probably be truer to say where God isn't is the real question. Because if God isn't wherever, then that wherever isn't. Did you follow that, though? Because that's a basic principle of who we are as Catholic Christians and believers of the faith. We believe that God is not bound by space or time. That means that when we really are trying to shape our experience of God, we have to be open to that. So what does that mean about heaven, hell, purgatory? Do we really think those are places? Is that really accurate with a God who isn't bound by space or time? I'm not about to answer that, but I do think it raises the questions that we need to take a look at again to say we can never completely understand this. This is mystery. So, institution, mystical communion, a sacrament, and outward. So the church is an outward sign. It's a community of people instituted by Christ. He gathered people among himself, around himself, and told them that they were church. And so the church is a sacrament of Christ. It's a herald. It proclaims the good news. This world that we live in needs to hear good news. Goodness sakes, in 2024, don't we need to hear some good news for a change?
Yes.
I can't listen much to the news that's presented because I need to know that stuff, but I don't want to know that stuff. I want to know there are other things that are more important. So, and then a servant, that was the one that knocked the socks off of a whole bunch of people, that the church would actually be a servant. Because for a very, very long time, that was not the vibe that a lot of people got from the Catholic Church. Just taking a look at the ambiance and the vestments. And I'm not knocking any of those things. But when we're at our most glorious, we might not be the most church. Because the church is a servant as well as an institution and all those other kinds of things. So the idea was that when one looks at church, again, the particular parish I go to is usually the way that I really look at church. But then if I go somewhere else, do you remember pre-Vatican II, it was always said, you could go anywhere in the world and the church would look the same, the mass would look the same, you could do it all. Well, no longer. And is that bad, or is that an enrichment of what the church does to represent how diverse God really is? So as Dulles was wrestling with all these different ways of looking at church, he, a little bit later on, thought, well, there's got to be one more, because it's not a closed system. So he came up with a sixth one, a community of disciples, a community, a group of people who are disciples, who are gathered to serve the Lord. There's a purpose to the community, and it extends beyond itself. Well, my suspicion is Dulles could have, in the last years of his life, come up with a seventh or eighth or ninth model. He didn't, but again, it's not a closed system. There can always be more. So Irwin took that idea and suggests 10 models of the Eucharist. He suggests that there's deep continuity with the forms of the Mass through the church's history. So what we're going to do, and I'm going to scoot through this because as all of, any of you who have heard me, maybe not in my homilies, because I really do try to have those be reasonably short or long, depending on how you look at it. But any of you who have been to any of my talks know that I get away with my away from myself, and I just keep talking. So I'm really gonna not do that. If God is helping me. What we're going to do, Irwin suggests 10 models of the Eucharist, 10 different ways that we can look at this way in which we gather together to celebrate the center of our lives as Catholic believers. We're going to look at 5 of these tonight. I'm going to skip this one because this just isn't important. It's a little too heady. It's a little too theological. So tonight we're going to explore 5 models. The memorial of the Paschal mystery, the Eucharist as a covenant renewal, the Eucharist as the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist as food for the journey, and the Eucharist as sacramental sacrifice. Now, one of the most important things that I think Irwin writes is that as we look at these different things, some of us will be drawn to one, or to two, or to three. Others of us will be drawn to others of them. It doesn't matter which ones. One's not better than the other. One's not more right than another one. These are simply reflections of how people approach what we do when we gather as the Eucharist. And so he also writes that unfortunately what's happened in the last 10 to 15 to 20 years, like in so many other areas of life, because people tend to look at their own view as the better view, or the best view, or the only view, they start politicizing the views. And you agree with it or you disagree with it, and you're put in a camp about what you think is right or what you think is wrong. Unfortunately, Irwin writes, and I agree with him on this point, there's become a kind of politicization in the last 20 years about whether we approach the Mass or the Eucharist as a sacrifice or a meal. And they're set apart from each other. It's either the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross, or it's the meal in which we remember the body and blood of Jesus. One or the other. That's so wrong. It's both and. It's another uniqueness, I think, about we Catholics. We are consistently supposed to be a both and church, rather than either or. Protestant churches are either or. That's why they protested against something they saw within the Catholic Church, didn't like it, protested it, and established what they considered to be the most important thing that they needed to do in order to follow God more carefully in their perspective. We Catholics, Catholic is supposed to mean big enough to include everybody. That's everybody. Even those who don't intend to be Catholic are included in the Catholic Church when we're at our best. Those people who are not Christian by choice are part of the church. Jesus has saved them every bit as much as he's saved us. We are both and people. And boy, it's tough to live like that. It's really tough to live like that in an election year. When we really stop to think about it, what are we electing? Are we electing between candidates for leadership, or are we electing to be a better nation? You know, what do our words mean, and how do we demonstrate that? So, anyway, the point being, We are both a sacrifice and a meal. And yes, there need to be times when we concentrate on one rather than the other, because we can only look at one avenue at a time. But that doesn't mean we can't walk around whatever we're looking at and see that there's really at least 360 degrees to everything we're looking at. I mean, if I may, just for a moment, you know, what's on the sheet of paper? Nothing from your perspective. From my perspective, all sorts of words. Plus, this is only two-dimensional, so if you went around the sheet of paper, you know, you'd find some other things if you could pull it apart a bit. The point being, truth, when we're trying to talk about truth and we're trying to talk about the source of truth, God, everything is diverse. Not really too complex. It can be very simple, but it can be very diverse and simple at the same time. So, Erwin is suggesting that no one of these is more important, but also that we should never isolate one from the other and say that one is better than the other. So the other five, just for your information, that we're not going to take a look at tonight, is the cosmic mass. That's a very fascinating chapter. By the way, you can pick up this book anytime. You can get it from any of your sources, Amazon, whatever. The cosmic mass. Are any of you familiar with a fellow by the name of Teilhard de Chardin? He was a paleontologist and a theologian in the 40s and 50s and 60s of the last century. Fascinating individual. Well, this particular chapter in this book is based on Chardin's work. He talks about the cosmic mass, that we don't have to be confined to the elements of bread and wine if we don't have any wheat and we don't have any grapes. There are other things that we can do that can transform and become the Eucharist. Fascinating chapter. The Church's Eucharist, the effective Word of God, active presence, and work of the Spirit. We're not going to do those, but pretty interesting. So the first one, and I'm just going to scoot through these. We'll have some time at the end if you'd like to explore some ideas. But, and again, I'm really trying to just smash your minds open with as much information as possible just to get you thinking. And maybe you'll come up with your own model of what it is when we gather together as God's people to celebrate the Eucharist. That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. So, model one, memorial of the Paschal Mystery. The Paschal Mystery, that's the death and resurrection of Jesus. That's what we do at the Triduum. That's what that term, the Paschal Mystery, means. It means the Easter Mystery. It comes from Pasch, the lamb, the Seder meal issue. So the Paschal Mystery is the heart of the matter when it comes to all liturgy. All liturgy is Easter. That actually means when you and I leave church on a Sunday morning or a Saturday night, we should feel alive again. I hope you do sometimes. You know, it's not easy to do that, especially because the Eucharist is a ritual. And when it's a ritual, it's the same. That's what makes it a ritual. It's the same thing over and over and over again. That's what makes us feel comfortable about it. That's what makes us understand what we're doing when we do it. However, if the ritual becomes just a ritual, then there's no meaning to it. So the idea is that the ritual of the Mass, like a birthday party, you know, you probably do the same things in a birthday party when you gather with your family. You do it in the same way. You don't blow the candles out before you sing happy birthday, usually. I mean, you just don't do that. So there are certain patterns, and it's good to do that, because if you walk into the room and you know the candles are lit, they still haven't sung happy birthday, so I'm on time. You know? So rituals can help, but if they stand in the way and you say you've got to do that or it isn't valid, the real thing is eating the cake. You know, not blowing out the candles. You know, so what's the purpose of the ritual? And if that's no longer being achieved, that stuff has to go away. It doesn't mean it wasn't important for a time, but it means it's lost its significance for a time. We can always bring it back. And that's what I think is happening in our church today with young people who are so interested in the Latin Mass or Latin as a language or so many kinds of the things that I grew up as a kid and moved away from learning the reasons why we were doing things in a different way. They never had those explanations. So for them, it's brand new stuff. They're really not interested in going back to the old. They're interested in seeing what they've missed. So we have to look at that. Because the Latin Mass is no better than the English Mass or the French Mass or the Chinese or whatever. It's the centerpiece of our lives, encountering Jesus. That's what's significant. Memorial is more than history. We make memory. We're not doing something just from the past. It's not memorial in that sense. Memorial is bringing to us what has gone on in the past and what continues to our very time. I don't know how many of you have ever heard the distinction between Kairos and Chronos time, but that's an important distinction to make when you're thinking about liturgy and thinking about some other things. There are two kinds of time. Chronos time is the kind of time that you observe on your watch. It's linear. It follows a certain pattern. That's Chronos time. Past, present, probably future. Okay? Kairos time is a moment, a special moment. You might not be able to remember the exact hour when a person who loved you said they loved you, or when you found out you were expecting a child, or when the child's birth occurred. You might not have the hour and the second exact, but that time is etched in your brain forever. That's Kairos time. That's what time is when we refer to it in terms of sacrament or celebration or eternity or God. It's Kairos time. So even the future building of God's kingdom is already happening now because it's Kairos time. It's not Chronos time. It's not just in the future. It's already happening. And we're participating in that ongoing Kairos time whenever we gather in Eucharist. To remember is to give life. To forget is to let die. So memorials are important. You know, what are the annual memorials that we celebrate as families or as citizens or as people of the earth? You know, we have these certain days when we come back and remind ourselves of that. Memorial does not involve repeating or redoing anything from the past. Rather, what happened in the past has saving consequences among us here in the present. We are remembering that God saved Israel because God is saving us. We remember getting the Ten Commandments because we're still trying to live with each other well. We bring ourselves into the occasions that have happened before. Is that tracking? Okay. Secondly, the covenant renewal. What we know from the Old Testament people of God is that God was wonderful at establishing covenants, promises, relational commitments. God wasn't so good at contracts. It didn't matter to God that the people with whom God was making an agreement would keep their end of the bargain or not. That's a contract. All that matters to God is that God said, "You're my beloved," and that never changes. Try as much as we might to not have God love us at times. God always loves us. God is always faithful. That's why it's not a contract, it's a covenant. When we gather in worship, we are talking about covenant. All of us need improvement and redemption, but all of us are acceptable to God. None of us is unwelcome at God's feast. Remember that Jesus never asked anyone to change before he helped them in the way they needed to be helped. He helped them, and then they changed. It was of their nature then to change because of what he did. He did not ask them to be perfect before he touched them. He doesn't ask us to be perfect before he loves us. And Jesus, creative God, the Father, the Mother, whatever term we might want to use, also welcomes us always. We may not welcome ourselves, and then we have some work to do before we come back. But that's on us. The covenant is never abandoned by God. This model, the covenant renewal, is particularly concerned with the relationship of baptism to Eucharist. Once we are baptized, everything's different. Once we are baptized, we enter into the sacramental system, the economy of salvation, it's called. And that's when Eucharist and every other sacrament begin to make sense. We are initiated into the sacramental system through baptism. Eucharist is the midpoint of initiation. Confirmation is the completion of the initiation sacraments, baptism, Eucharist, and confirmation. And so that helps us unite ourselves closer and closer with the Trinity. The new covenant is renewed in the sacrifice of Christ, commemorated in a special way within the Triduum. Holy Thursday, Good Friday, Holy Saturday. The richness of that experience. And then Easter Sunday is merely, not merely, but Easter Sunday is the reincorporation of Holy Thursday, Good Friday, and Holy Saturday. For biblical religion, blood signifies life. When a biblical covenant was sealed in blood, usually the blood of a lamb, it signified the life and vitality that would derive from that covenant. The blood was there to symbolize new life, not the death of whatever it was that was sacrificed, not the death of Jesus, but the new life that Jesus brought. Model 3, the Lord's Supper. Ritual dining ratifies our commitment to God and to each other in and through the Eucharist. This is what I believe we should be spending most of our time doing if we want to really bring people back to the Eucharist. It's not talking about theological terms. It's not talking about trying to have things be more and more sacred. It's to teach people how to eat again. Because Jesus very, very deliberately used the occasion of the Last Supper and bread and wine, the nourishment that we need as people, to say, this is my body, this is my blood. And he didn't say then, depart from it out of fear. He said, eat this. Well, we don't know how to eat as families anymore. We haven't for a long time. Maybe Christmas, Thanksgiving, if your family doesn't live too far away so that they can't afford to come home, or maybe birthdays. But post-COVID, when none of us could get together, we hungered for the Eucharist. Didn't you hunger for the very first time we could get back to church? And spiritual communion's fine. No, it isn't. not when we're really human people who hunger. But a little piece of bread and a little sip of wine cannot have much meaning at all when we don't know what it is to prepare a meal, to pay what it takes to get the elements of the meal together, to take the time to prepare the meal, to sit down and celebrate it and enjoy each other while we're enjoying the meal. That's what we've forgotten. That's what we need to invite our young people. I mean, fast food restaurants, they're no help. The stuff that we can do on the internet to access the scriptures, that's no help when we need to hear the word of God explained well on a Sunday morning. We hunger for real stuff, not just what things are supposed to mean. Yes, it's important for us to get on our knees to the holiness of God at times, but it's more important for us to figure out what people are really hungering for now that's keeping them away. Or what it was that we weren't giving them enough of to bring them to want to come back. I really, really believe we've not been doing the job we should be doing. And I've said this to a couple people who have positions of relative authority in the church, and they don't pay attention to me, and they don't need to. But I'll bet you I'm right in most cases. What's going to bring people back to the church is a sense of hunger, not a sense of holiness, until the hunger gets fed and holiness is understood. I'm not diminishing the importance of holiness, but I'm saying those of you who are teachers know a six-year-old child does not get a concept about calculus. I never got that chip, but a six-year-old does not understand calculus. Somebody who doesn't know how to eat and the meaning of a meal and is only eating to quench their own hunger cannot understand the essence of the Eucharist. It's my bias. You heard me. You can quote me. I'm retired. The supper meal context is crucial for any interpretation of the Eucharist, sacrament and sacrifice. Because when we gather together to eat a meal together, we've sacrificed, those of us who have prepared the meal, or who have had to pay for the food that we're putting on the table, or just sitting down and being nice to each other at times. You know, there's a cost to that kind of stuff. But that's what makes it purposeful and meaningful. If it's just there for us, I was going to jump off and I won't. I'll just say there's a similar feeling and attitude that I have about why we've gone back to confession rather than reconciliation. It's so much easier to confess and not do anything about it than it is to really reconcile oneself in a way that one needs to. I don't think frequent confession is helping us get to be better people. All that's helping us do is remember what we need to do to get better. It's not asking us to make the step to get better. So I have an issue with that, too, and you can quote me on that. Anyway, the Lord's Supper is a relational act of giving and receiving. Model 4, it's food for the journey. For the journey. It's not just food for now. It's food for the journey. There is always a future element, or in this Kairos kind of time frame that we were talking about earlier. It's always toward a completion that we are looking. So it's food for the journey. It's not just food for ourselves or food for the moment. It's food to be nourished so that we can become better at our task of building the kingdom with Jesus' help. Equally important, it is food for the journey to the second coming. It is food for the journey of going through the pattern that Jesus had to. Death and resurrection. We hunger for meaning when we face our own death. There is food for the journey for that experience. That's another whole element of the richness of the Eucharist. It's not just for now and for this moment. It's for eternity. Irwin talks about the fact that this model focuses on how the Eucharist ritualizes and realizes all that has been accomplished in and through Christ, even as the church yearns for its fulfillment, as we long for Christ who is to come again. Remember, scripturally based, the purpose of our lives is not to get to heaven. The purpose of our lives is to experience the kingdom of God here on earth in Jesus' return. It's a very significant thing to ponder. It's not an easy thing to come to an awareness of, because we've grown up with this attitude about that's what we should be about. It isn't. Jesus inaugurated the kingdom, has returned to the Father's glory, and will return again in glory, we say, to establish the kingdom here. This is where we're supposed to be holy. This is where we're supposed to be living. This is where we're supposed to be concerned about. And sometimes we get distracted by thinking about another place other than the place where God immersed us and created us to be. This model explores the incompleteness of the Christian life and emphasizes the eschatological. That's a $20,000 word. All it really means is the afterlife. The eschaton is the life to come. That really, if you're taking it out of space and time, simply means the fullness of life. Everything about life, joined together, united. Everyone who has been before, all those people we are missing, all those people you might look forward to as your children or grandchildren still to come, we're all going to be in this together. That's how we can be the fullness of who we are. This model hearkens to God providing manna in the desert. Consistently, God has helped people be nourished when they need to be, in unexpected ways. The Hebrews had no idea what that crazy stuff was in the desert. They didn't know what it was, but they ate it because they needed it, and they needed the nourishment, and it preceded them. God gave them a faithful understanding of God's presence. It's fulfilled, but not yet complete. The promise has been proclaimed. We're just not all in it yet. So again, we need to keep understanding the transcendence of space and time. Two special things about this particular model, viaticum and sancta. Now, viaticum, some of you may be familiar with. Viaticum is, in the tradition of the church, it's the last communion that someone receives. Way back when we used to call the sacrament of the sick extreme unction, and we sort of got frightened by that sacrament because, you know, if you weren't feeling too well and you saw somebody coming in a Roman collar, you weren't feeling much better. The idea was it was supposed to help you feel healed, help you feel the compassion of God, but we turn these things into fear. Well, there was this special kind of thing where you received communion for the last time. And that got to be real iffy too, because then we waited, you know, we had people wait around until they were really just about done before you'd call for the priest to give them communion. It was never the intention. Again, we have to break those space-time patterns and see the reality of what we're trying to do. We're supposed to be giving food for the journey to a person who's on this journey, not to the end, but to a new beginning. Death is not the end. It's not the last meal. It's a transitional meal to the fullness of life. Sancta was that little bit of, and sometimes you'll see it, it's back in our ritual today. For a while, it wasn't right after the Second Vatican Council, but where the priest breaks the host. Now, and you do know, it's in the breaking of the bread and the sharing of the cup that Jesus has made present. Not just in the bread and the wine. It's the breaking of the bread and the sharing of the cup. It's the action that makes Christ present, okay? So that little piece, when the host is broken and then a little piece is put into the chalice, which is supposed to signify the unity of the body and blood. Originally, the sancta happened in a way that the bread that the Pope at his Mass on a Sunday would break the bread, and then a portion of it was distributed to the churches in the area of the city of Rome. That's the sancta. It represented the unity of those other churches with the head church. Okay? You're also aware that St. Peter's is not the cathedral in Rome. St. John Lateran is the cathedral. Okay? St. Peter's is a basilica. Special church, absolutely. But, you know, we sometimes make these assumptions that we think we know about, and they're not quite accurate. Okay? But at any rate, these things are important in our tradition in the church. Model 5, a sacramental sacrifice. Here's where we get to that point that I was trying to make before. It's both those things. It's a sacrament, so it's a meal as well as a sacrifice. Neither one nor the other of those two ideas is sufficient to understand the Eucharist as we understand it. It is a sacrament, it is food, and it's a sacrifice. Sacrifice conveys many meanings: self-deprivation, inconvenience, even suffering. But in a religious context, sacrifice is a very significant and highly charged term. It comes from sacrum facere, which means to make holy. It doesn't mean to hurt. It doesn't mean to kill. It doesn't mean to suffer. It means to make holy. So do our sacrifices make things holy? That's what we should be able to use as a criterion to figure out if what we're doing is purposeful and adequate and blessed. We are all made holy by engaging in the Eucharistic action and by living lives in deliberate obedience to God's will. Not because I have to, but I want to. That's what obedience is. Obedience is not doing something because somebody else has told me it. It's not because I have to. It's because I choose to do it for the sake of right. We are given freedom in everything we do, and we so often give our responsibility to other people. And then we can blame them. And that's not the point at all. Real obedience is a choice that I make to do what I do because it gives me life. The Mass is at one and the same time a sacrifice of praise, thanksgiving, appropriation, and satisfaction. That comes from, have any of you heard of the germ? That's the general instruction for the Roman Missal, in case you don't know what that means. It's not G-E-R-M. The germ is our guiding text for the way in which we celebrate the rituals at the current time. And there have been different iterations of that. So, with all of this said, you're being very patient and you're seeing, at least your eyes are open, so that's nice. Thank you, I appreciate that. Just by way of a reflection that I'd ask you to think about, and we only have 5-6 minutes, so we're not going to get real deeply into this right now, but I'd ask you please, when you go home and this next week, think about some of this stuff. How does a biblical and liturgical understanding of the word memory broaden your normal understanding of the word? I'm so aware of the fact that my brain has retired quicker than I am. What is it when you get these cliff notes? This is what I'm trying to think of. Okay. So, the cliff note version of this one is, memory is not just something in the past. How do you bring to the present things that have mattered to you? That's what memory is all about. It's not primarily remembering in the past. It's bringing forward to the present. How do you see the Eucharist as participation in the covenant between God and humankind? Remember, every time we come together in worship, we're refocusing our awareness and reparticipating in the reality of being united again to the covenant that God has offered us through baptism. How can we reestablish the significance of eating a meal together to further appreciate the Mass as the Lord's Supper? How do I see the Eucharist as food for the journey, even food for my journey? Now, how is the Eucharist food for the walk I'm taking in life? How do I see the Eucharist as both sacrament and sacrifice? So we're not going to do this either because I've taken all your time and we only have 5 minutes left. What I was going to invite you to do was, as your small groups, take some time to think about if anything that I said mattered to you, or you took particular interest in what I was saying, or a particular issue with the approach that I took, to sort of talk about that. And then how these models enriched your appreciation for the Eucharist. And then probably most importantly, I would like you to think about one concrete way in which your parish can increase awareness and appreciation of the Eucharist. You know, if we're spending time as adults thinking about this, and you're doing this throughout the Lenten season around different aspects of this reality about the Eucharist, what's one concrete thing that you can take to your own parish and suggest as a way of increasing awareness and appreciation of the Eucharist. I'll bet you, if you process that well and you took it either to your liturgy committees or to your pastoral council, or Kim is saying, to me. If you take it to Kim, not all at once because you'll trample her, but I really ask you, and not just off the top of your head, try to really think about one significant thing that you could suggest that your parish could do to really help people understand the richness of this Eucharistic reality that we are. The body and blood of Christ, yes, but also as we gather together to celebrate and to ritualize the presence of Jesus among us.